His walk along the lake path had been both long and slow, and Amy's call hadn't been the only thing Mort had thought about as he picked his way over or around the occasional downed tree, or paused to skip the occasional flat stone across the water. As a boy, he had been able to get a really good one, what they called a flatty, to skip as many as 9 times, but today 4 was the most he'd been able to manage. He had also thought about how to deal with Shooter, when and if Shooter turned up again. It was true he had felt a transient, or maybe not so transient, guilt when he saw how close to identical the 2 stories were, but he had worked that one out. It was only the generalized guilt he guessed all writers of fiction felt from time to time. As for Shooter himself, the only feelings he had were annoyance, anger, and a kind of relief. He was full of an unfocused rage, had been for months. It was good to finally have a donkey to pin this rotten, stinking tail on. Mort had heard the old saw about how if 400 monkeys banged away on 400 typewriters for 4 million years, one of them would produce the complete works of Shakespeare. He didn't believe it. Even if it were true, John Shooter was no monkey, and he hadn't been alive anywhere near that long, no matter how lined his face was. So Shooter had copied his story. Why he had picked sowing season was beyond Mort Rainey's powers of conjecture. But he knew that was what had happened, because he had ruled out coincidence, and he knew damn well that while he might have stolen that story, like all his others, from the great idea bank of the universe, he most certainly had not stolen it from Mr. John Shooter of the great state of Mississippi. Where then had Shooter copied it from? Mort thought that was the most important question. His chance to expose Shooter as a fake and a cheat might lie buried within the answer to it. There were only 2 possible answers, because Sowing Season had only been published twice, first in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, and then in his collection Everybody Drops the Dime. The dates of publication for the short stories in a collection are usually listed on the copyright page at the front of the book, and this format had been followed in Everybody Drops the Dime. He had looked up the acknowledgement for Sowing Season and found that it had been originally published in the June 1980 issue of EQMM. The collection Everybody Drops the Dime had been issued by St. Martin's Press in 1983. There had been subsequent printing since then, all but one of them in paperback, but that didn't matter. All he really had to work with were those 2 dates, 1980 and 1983, and his own hopeful belief that aside from agents and publishing company lawyers, no one really paid much attention to those lines of fine print on the copyright page. Hoping that this would prove true of John Shooter, hoping that Shooter would simply assume, as most general readers did, that a story he had read for the first time in a collection had no prior existence, Mort approached the man and finally stood before him on the edge of the road. "I guess you must have had a chance to read my story by now," Shooter said. He spoke as casually as a man commenting on the weather. "I did." Shooter nodded gravely. "I imagine it rang a bell, didn't it?" "It certainly did," Mort agreed, and then with studied casualness, "When did you write it?" "I thought you'd ask that," Shooter said. He smiled a secret little smile, but said no more. His arms remained crossed over his chest, his hands laid against his sides just below the armpits. He looked like a man who would be perfectly content to remain where he was forever, or at least until the sun sank below the horizon and ceased to warm his face. "Well, sure," Mort said, still casually. "I have to, you know. I mean, when 2 fellows show up with the same story, that's serious." "Serious," Shooter agreed in a deeply meditative tone of voice. "And the only way to sort a thing like that out," Mort continued, "to decide who copied from whom, is to find out who wrote the words first." He fixed Shooter's faded blue eyes with his own dry and uncompromising gaze. Somewhere nearby, a chickadee twittered self-importantly in a tangle of trees and was then quiet again. "Wouldn't you say that's true?" "I suppose I would," Shooter agreed. "I suppose that's why I came all the way up here from Mississippi." Mort heard the rumble of an approaching vehicle. They both turned in that direction, and Tom Greenleaf's scout came over the nearest hill, pulling a little cyclone of fallen leaves behind it. Tom, a hale and healthy Tashmore native of 70-something, was the caretaker for most of the places on this side of the lake that Greg Carstairs didn't handle. Tom raised one hand in salute as he passed. Mort waved back. Shooter removed one hand from its resting place and tipped a finger at Tom in a friendly gesture which spoke in some obscure way of a great many years spent in the country, of the uncountable and unrecollected number of times he had saluted the passing drivers of passing trucks and tractors and tedders and balers in that exact same casual way. Then, as Tom's scout passed out of sight, he returned his hand to his rib cage so that his arms were crossed again. As the leaves rattled to rest on the road, his patient, unwavering, almost eternal gaze came back to Mort Rainey's face once more. "Now, what were we saying?" he asked almost gently. "We were trying to establish provenance," Mort said. "That means I know what it means," Shooter said, favoring Mort with a glance which was both calm and mildly contemptuous. "I know I am wearing shit-kicker clothes and driving a shit-kicker car, and I come from a long line of shit-kickers. And maybe that makes me a shit-kicker myself, but it doesn't necessarily make me a stupid shit-kicker." "No," Mort agreed, "I don't guess it does. But being smart doesn't necessarily make you honest, either. In fact, I think it's more often apt to go the other way. I could figure that much out from you, had I not known it," Shooter said dryly. And Mort felt himself flush. He didn't like to be zinged, and rarely was, but Shooter had just done it with the effortless ease of an experienced shotgunner popping a clay pigeon. His hopes of trapping Shooter dropped, not all the way to zero, but quite a considerable way. Smart and sharp were not the same things, but he now suspected that Shooter might be both. Still, there was no sense drawing this out. He didn't want to be around the man any longer than he had to be. In some strange way, he had looked forward to this confrontation, once he had become sure that another confrontation was inevitable, maybe only because it was a break in a routine which had already become dull and unpleasant. Now, he wanted it over. He was no longer sure John Shooter was crazy, not completely anyway, but he thought the man could be dangerous. He was so goddamn implacable. He decided to take his best shot and get it over with. No more dancing around. "When did you write your story, Mr. Shooter?"
"Maybe my name's not Shooter," the man said, looking faintly amused. "Maybe that's just a pen name."
"I see. Well, what's your real one?"
"I didn't say it wasn't. I only said maybe. Either way, that's not part of our business."
He spoke serenely, appearing to be more interested in a cloud which was making its way slowly across the high blue sky and toward the westering sun. "Okay," Mort said, "but when you wrote that story, is..."
"I wrote it 7 years ago," he said, still studying the cloud.
It had touched the edge of the sun now, and it acquired a gold fringe. "In 1982.
Bingo, Mort thought.
Wily old bastard or not, he stepped right into the trap after all. He got the story out of the collection all right, and since Everybody Drops a Dime was published in 1983, he thought any date before then had to be safe. Should have read the copyright page, old son. He waited for a feeling of triumph, but there was none. Only a muted sense of relief that this nut could be sent on his merry way with no further fuss or muss. Still, he was curious. It was the curse of the writing class. For example, why that particular story, a story which was so out of his usual run, so downright atypical? And if the guy was going to accuse him of plagiarism, why settle for an obscure short story when he could have cobbled up the same sort of almost identical manuscript of a bestseller like The Organ Grinder's Boy? That would have been juicy. This was almost a joke. Oh, I suppose knocking off one of the novels would have been too much like work, Mort thought. "Why did you wait so long?" he asked. "I mean, my book of short stories was published in 1983, and that's 6 years ago, going on 7 now."
"Because I didn't know," Shooter said.
He removed his gaze from the cloud and studied Mort with that discomforting look of faint contempt again.
"A man like you, I suppose that kind of man just assumes everyone in America, not everyone in every country where his books are published, reads what he has written."
"I know better than that, I think," Mort said, and it was his turn to be dry.
"But that's not true," Shooter went on,
ignoring what Mort had just said in his scarily serene and utterly fixated way.
"That is not true at all. I never saw that story until the middle of June. This June."
Mort thought of saying, "Well, guess what, Johnny, me boy? I never saw my wife in bed with another man until the middle of May." Would it knock Shooter off his pace if he actually did say something like that out loud? He looked into the man's face and decided not. The serenity had burned out of those faded eyes the way mist burns off the hills on a day which is going to be a real scorcher. Now Shooter looked like a fundamentalist preacher about to ladle a large helping of fire and brimstone upon the trembling downcast heads of his flock. And for the first time, Mort Rainey felt really and personally afraid of the man. Yet he was also still angry. The thought he had had near the end of his first encounter with John Shooter now recurred. Scared or not, he was damned if he was going to just stand here and take it while this man accused him of theft, especially now that the falsity had been revealed out of the man's own mouth. "Let me guess," Mort said. "A guy like you is a little too picky about what he reads to bother with the sort of trash I write. You stick to guys like Marcel Proust and Thomas Hardy, right? At night, after the milking's done, you like to fire up one of those honest country kerosene lamps, plunk it down on the kitchen table, which is, of course, covered with a homey red and white check tablecloth, and unwind with a little Tess or remembrance of things past. Maybe on the weekend you let your hair down a little, get a little funky, drag out some Erskine Caldwell or Annie Dillard. It was one of your friends who told you about how I'd copied your honestly wrought tale. Isn't that how the story goes, Mr. Shooter, or whatever your name is?" His voice had taken on a rough edge, and he was surprised to find himself on the edge of real fury. But he discovered not totally surprised. "Nope, I don't have any friends." Shooter spoke in the dry tone of a man who was only stating a fact. "No friends, no family, no wife. I've got a little place about 20 miles south of Perkinsburg, and I do have a check tablecloth on my kitchen table, now that you mention it, but we got electric lights on our town. I only bring out the kerosenes when there's a storm and the lines go down." "Good for you," Mort said. Shooter ignored the sarcasm. "I got the place for my father, and added to it with a little money that came to me from my gram. I do have a dairy herd, about 20 milkers. You were right about that, too. And in the evenings, I write stories. I suppose you've got one of those fancy computers with a screen, but I make do with an old typewriter." He fell silent, and for a moment they could both hear the crisp rustle of the leaves and the light late afternoon wind that had sprung up. "As for your story being the same as mine, I found that out all on my own hook. You see, I'd been thinking about selling the farm, thinking that with a little more money I could write days when my mind's fresh, instead of just after dark. The realtor up in Perkinsburg wanted me to meet a fellow up in Jackson who owns a lot of dairy farms in Mississippi. I don't like to drive more than 10-15 miles at a time. It gives me a headache, especially when some of it's city driving, because that's where they let all the fools loose, so I took the bus. I got ready to get on and then remembered I hadn't brought anything to read. I hate a long bus ride without something to read." Mort found himself nodding involuntarily. He also hated a ride, bus, train, plane, or car, without something to read, something a little more substantial than the daily paper. "There isn't any bus station in Perkinsburg. Greyhound just stops at the Rexall for 5 minutes or so, and then it's down the road. I was already inside the door of that hound, starting up the steps when I realized I was empty-handed. I asked the bus driver if he'd hold it for me, and he said he was damned if he would. He was late already. He was pulling out in another 3 minutes by his pocket watch. If I was with him, that'd be fine by him. And if I wasn't, then I could kiss his fanny when we met up again." He talks like a storyteller, Mort thought. Be damned if he doesn't. He tried to cancel this thought. It didn't seem to be a good way to be thinking, and couldn't quite do it. "Well, I ran inside that drugstore. They got one of those old-fashioned wire paperback racks in the Perkinsburg Rexall, the ones that turn round and round, just like the one in that little general store up the road from you." "Bowie's?" Shooter nodded. "That's the place, all right. Anyway, I grabbed the first book my hand happened on. Could have been a paperback Bible for all I saw of the cover, but it wasn't. It was your book of short stories. Everybody Drops the Dime. For all I know, they were your short stories. All but that one." Stop this now. He's working up a head of steam, so spike his boiler right now. But he discovered he didn't want to. Maybe Shooter was a writer. He fulfilled both of the main requirements. He told a tale you wanted to hear to the end, even if you had a pretty good idea what the end was going to be. And he was so full of shit, he squeaked. Instead of saying what he should have said, that even if Shooter was by some wild stretch of the imagination telling the truth, he, Mort, had beaten him to that miserable story by 2 years, he said, "So you read Sowing Season on a Greyhound bus while you were going to Jackson to sell your dairy farm last June?"
"No. The way it happened, I read it on the way back. I sold the farm and went on the Greyhound with a check for $60,000 in my pocket. I'd read the first half a dozen stories going down. I didn't think they were any great shakes, but they passed the time.
Thank you." Shooter studied him briefly. "Wasn't offering you any real compliment. Don't I know it?" Shooter thought about this for a moment, then shrugged.
"Anyway, I read two more going back. And then that one. My story."
He looked at the cloud, which was now an airy mass of shimmering gold, and then back at Mort. His face was as dispassionate as ever, but Mort suddenly understood he had been badly mistaken in believing this man possessed even the slightest shred of peace or serenity. What he had mistaken for those things was the iron mantle of control Shooter had donned to keep himself from killing Morton Rainey with his bare hands. The face was dispassionate, but his eyes blazed with the deepest, wildest fury Mort had ever seen. He understood that he had stupidly walked up the path from the lake toward what might really be his own death at this fellow's hands. Here was a man mad enough, in both senses of that word, to do murder.
"I am surprised no one has taken that story up with you before. It's not like any of the others. Not a bit."
Shooter's voice was still even, but Mort now recognized it as the voice of a man laboring mightily to keep from striking out, bludgeoning, perhaps throttling. The voice of a man who knows that all the incentive he would ever need to cross the line between talking and killing would be to hear his own voice begin to spiral upward into the registers of cheated anger. The voice of a man who knows how fatally easy it would be to become his own lynch mob. Mort suddenly felt like a man in a dark room, which is crisscrossed with hair-thin tripwires, all of them leading to packets of high explosive. It was hard to believe that only moments ago he had felt in charge of this situation. His problems, Amy, his inability to write, now seemed like unimportant figures in an unimportant landscape. In a sense, they had ceased to be problems at all. He only had one problem now, and that was staying alive long enough to get back to his house, let alone long enough to see the sun go down. He opened his mouth, then closed it again. There was nothing he dared to say. Not now. The room was full of tripwires.
"I am very surprised," Shooter repeated in that heavy, even voice that now sounded like a hideous parody of calmness.
Mort heard himself say, "My wife, she didn't like it. She said that it wasn't like anything I'd ever written before."
"How did you get it?" Shooter asked slowly and fiercely. "That's what I really want to know. How in hell did a big-money scribbling asshole like you get down to a little shit-splat town in Mississippi and steal my goddamn story? I'd like to know why, too. Unless you stole all the other ones as well, but the how of it'll be enough to satisfy me right now."
The monstrous unfairness of this brought Mort's own anger back like an unslaked thirst. For a moment he forgot that he was out here on Lake Drive, alone except for this lunatic from Mississippi. "Drop it," he said harshly.
"Drop it?"
Shooter asked, looking at Mort with a kind of clumsy amazement.
"Drop it? What in the hell do you mean, drop it?"
"You said you wrote your story in 1982, Mort said. "I think I wrote mine in late 1979. I can't remember the exact date, but I do know that it was published for the first time in June of 1980 in a magazine. I beat you by 2 years, Mr. Shooter, or whatever your name is. If anyone here has got a bitch about plagiarism, it's me." Mort did not precisely see the man move. At one moment, they were standing by Shooter's car, looking at each other. At the next, he found himself pressed against the driver's door with Shooter's hands wrapped around his upper arms and Shooter's face pressed against his own, forehead to forehead. in between his two positions. There was only a blurred sensation of being first grabbed and then whirled. "You lie," Shooter said, and on his breath was a dry whiff of cinnamon. "The fuck I do," Mort said, and lunged forward against the man's pressing weight. Shooter was strong, almost certainly stronger than Mort Rainey, but Mort was younger, heavier, and he had the old blue station wagon to push against. He was able to break Shooter's hold and send him stumbling two or three steps backward. "Now he'll come for me," Mort thought. Although he hadn't had a fight since the schoolyard you-pull-me-and-I'll-push-you scuffle back in the fourth grade, he was astounded to find his mind was clear and cool. "We're gonna duke it out over that dumb fucking story. Well, okay. I wasn't doing anything else today anyhow." But it didn't happen. Shooter raised his hands, looked at them, saw they were knotted into fists, and forced them to open. Mort saw the effort it took for the man to reimpose that mantle of control and felt a kind of awe. Shooter put one of his open palms to his mouth and wiped his lips with it, very slowly and very deliberately. "Prove it," he said. "All right, come back to the house with me. I'll show you the entry on the copyright page of the book." "No," Shooter said. "I don't care about the book. I don't care pins for the book. Show me the story. Show me the magazine with the story in it so I can read it for myself." "I don't have the magazine here." He was about to say something else, but Shooter turned his face up toward the sky and uttered a single bark of laughter. The sound was as dry as an axe splitting kindling wood. "No," he said. The fury was still blazing and dancing in his eyes, but he seemed in charge of himself again. "No, I bet you don't." "Listen to me," Mort said. "Ordinarily, this is just a place my wife and I come in the summer. I have copies of my books here and some foreign editions, but I've published in a lot of magazines as well, articles and essays as well as stories. Those magazines are in our year-round house, the one in Derry." "Then why aren't you there?" Shooter asked. In his eyes, Mort read both disbelief and a galling satisfaction. It was clear that Shooter had expected him to try and squirm his way out of it. And in Shooter's mind, that was just what Mort was doing, or trying to do. "I'm here because..." He stopped. "How did you know I'd be here?" "I just looked on the back of the book I bought," Shooter said. And Mort could have slapped his own forehead in frustration and sudden understanding. Of course. There had been a picture of him on the back of both the hardcover and paperback editions of Everybody Drops the Dime. Amy had taken it herself, and it had been an excellent shot. He was in the foreground, the house was in the middle distance, Tashmore Lake was in the background. The caption had read simply, "Morton Rainey at his home in Western Maine." So Shooter had come to Western Maine, and he probably hadn't had to visit too many small-town bars and or drugstores before he found someone who said, "Mort Rainey? Hell yes, got a place over in Tashmore. Personal friend of mine, in fact." Well, that answered one question anyway. "I'm here because my wife and I got a divorce," he said. "It just became final. She stayed in Derry. Any other year, the house down here would have been empty." "Uh-huh," Shooter said. His tone of voice infuriated Mort all over again. "You're lying," it said. "But in this case, it doesn't much matter, because I knew you'd lie. After all, lying is mostly what you're about, isn't it?"
"Well, I would have found you one place or the other."
He fixed Mort with a flinty stare.
"I would have found you if you'd moved to Brazil."
"I believe that," Mort said. "Nevertheless, you are mistaken, or conning me. I'll do you the courtesy of believing it's only a mistake, because you seem sincere enough." "Oh, God, didn't he? But I published that story 2 years before you say you wrote it." He saw that mad flash in Shooter's eyes again. And then it was gone. Not extinguished, but collared, the way a man might collar a dog with an evil nature.
"You say this magazine's at your other house?"
"Yes."
"And the magazine has your story in it?"
"Yes."
"And the date of that magazine is June 1980.
"Yes." Mort had felt impatient with this laborious catechism. There was a long, thoughtful pause before each question, at first. But now he felt a little hope. It was as if the man was trying to teach himself the truth of what Mort had said, A truth, Mort thought, that part of John Shooter must have known all along, because the almost exact similarity between the two stories was not coincidence. He still believed that firmly, but he had come around to the idea that Shooter might have no conscious memory of committing the plagiarism, because the man was clearly mad. He wasn't quite as afraid as he had been when he first saw the hate and fury dancing in Shooter's eyes, like the reflection of a barn fire blazing out of control. When he pushed the man, he had staggered backward, and Mort thought that if it came to a fight, he could probably hold his own, or actually put his man on the ground. Still, it would be better if it didn't come to that. In an odd, backhand sort of way, he had begun to feel a bit sorry for Shooter. That gentleman, meanwhile, was stolidly pursuing his course.
This other house, the one your wife has now, it's here in Maine, too?
Yes.
And she's there?
Yes.
There was a much longer pause this time.
In a weird way, Shooter reminded Mort of a computer processing a heavy load of information. At last, he said,
I'll give you 3 days.
That's very generous of you, Mort said. Shooter's long upper lip drew back from teeth too even to be anything but mail-order dentures.
Don't you make light of me, son, he said. I'm trying my best to hold my temper, and doing a pretty good job of it, but...
You, Mort cried at him, what about me? This is unbelievable. You come out of nowhere and make just about the most serious accusation a man can make against a writer, and when I tell you I've got proof you're either mistaken or lying through your damn teeth, you start patting yourself on the back for holding your temper. It's unbelievable.
Shooter's eyelids drooped, giving him a sly look. Proof? He said. I don't see no proof. I hear you talking. But talking ain't proof.
I told you, Mort shouted. He felt helpless, like a man trying to box cobwebs. I explained all that. Shooter looked at Mort for a long moment, then turned and reached through the open window of his car. What are you doing? Mort asked, his voice tight. Now he felt the adrenaline dump into his body, readying him for fight or flight. Probably the latter, if Shooter was reaching for the big handgun Mort suddenly saw in the eye of his imagination.
Just getting my smokes, Shooter said. Hold your water.
When he pulled his arm out of the car, he had a red package of Pall Malls in his hand. He had taken them off the dashboard.
Want one?
I have my own, Mort said rather sulkily, and took the ancient pack of L&M's from the pocket beneath the red flannel overshirt. They lit up, each from his own pack.
If we keep on this way, we're going to have a fight, Shooter said finally. I don't want that.
Well, Jesus, neither do I.
Part of you does, Shooter contradicted.
He continued to study Mort from beneath his dropped lids with that expression of country shrewdness.
Part of you wants just that. But I don't think it's just me or my story that's making you want to fight. You've got some other bee under your blanket that's got you all riled up, and that is making this harder. Part of you wants to fight. What you don't understand is that if we do start to fight, it's not going to end until one or the other of us is dead.
Mort looked for signs that Shooter was exaggerating for effect and saw none. He suddenly felt cold all along the base of his spine.
So I'm going to give you 3 days. You call your ex and get her to send down the magazine with your story in it, if there is such a magazine, and I'll be back. There isn't any magazine, of course. I think we both know that, but you strike me as a man who needs to do some long, hard thinking.
He looked at Mort with a disconcerting expression of stern pity.
You didn't believe anybody would ever catch you out, did you? He asked. You really didn't.
If I show you the magazine, will you go away? Mort asked. He was speaking more to himself than to Shooter. I guess what I really want to know is whether or not it's even worth it. Shooter abruptly opened his car door and slid in behind the wheel. Mort found the speed with which the man could move a little creepy.
3 days. Use it the way you like, Mr. Rainey.
He started the engine, It ran with the low wheeze characteristic of valves which need to be reground, and the tang of oil smoke from the old tailpipe polluted the air of the fading afternoon.
Right is right, and fail is fail. First thing is to get you to a place where you see I've really got you. And you can't wiggle out of this mess the way you've probably been wiggling out of the messes you've made all your life. That's the first thing.
He looked at Mort expressionlessly out of the driver's side window.
The second thing, he said, is the real reason I come.
What's that? Mort heard himself say.
It was strange, and not a little infuriating, but he felt that sensation of guilt creeping relentlessly over him again, as if he really had done the thing of which this rustic lunatic was accusing him. We'll talk about it, Shooter said, and threw his elderly station wagon in gear. Meantime, you think about what's right and what's fair.
You're nuts, Mort shouted, but Shooter was already rolling up Lake Drive toward where it spilled out onto Route 23. He watched until the wagon was out of sight, then walked slowly back to the house. It felt emptier and emptier in his mind as he drew closer and closer to it. The rage and the fear were gone. He felt only cold, tired, and homesick for a marriage which no longer was, and which, it now began to seem to him, had never been at all. The telephone started ringing when he was halfway along the driveway which ran down the steep hill from Lake Drive to the house. Mort broke into a run, knowing he wasn't going to make it, but running anyway, cursing himself for his foolish reaction. Talk about Pavlov's dogs. He had opened the screen door and was fumbling with the knob of the inside door when the phone silenced. He stepped in, closed the door behind him, and looked at the telephone, which stood on a little antique desk Amy had picked up at a flea market in Mechanic Falls. He could, in that moment, easily imagine that the phone was looking back at him with studied mechanical impatience. Don't ask me, boss. I don't make the news. I only report it. He thought that he ought to buy one of those machines that take messages. Or maybe not. When he thought about it carefully, he realized that the telephone was hardly his favorite gadget. If people really wanted you, they eventually called back. He made himself a sandwich and a bowl of soup and then discovered he didn't want them. He felt lonely, unhappy, and mildly infected by John Shooter's craziness. He was not much surprised to find that the sum of these feelings was sleepiness. He began to cast longing glances at the couch.
Okay, an interior voice whispered. Remember, though, you can run, but you can't hide. This shit is still going to be here when you wake up.
That was very true, he thought, but in the meantime it would all be gone, gone, definitely, blessedly gone. The one thing you could definitely say for short-term solutions was that they were better than nothing. He decided he would call home. His mind persisted in thinking of the dairy house as home, and he suspected that was a circumstance which would not soon change. Ask Amy to pull the copy of EQMM with sowing season in it and send it down by express mail. Then he would sack on the couch for a couple of hours. He would arise around 7 or so, go into the study, refreshed, and write a little more shit.
And shit is all you will write with that attitude, the interior voice reproached him.
Fuck you, Mort told it. One of the few advantages to living alone, so far as he could see, was that you could talk to yourself right out loud, without having anyone wonder if you were crazy or what. He picked up the phone and dialed a dairy number. He listened to the customary clicks of the long-distance connection being made, and then that most irritating of all telephone sounds, the da-da-da of a busy signal. Amy was on the telephone with someone, and when Amy really got going, a conversation could go on for hours, possibly days.
Oh, fuck, great,
Mort cried, and jacked the handset back into the cradle hard enough to make the bell jingle faintly.
So, what now, little man?
He supposed he could call Isabel Fortin, who lived across the street, but that suddenly seemed like too much work and a pain in the ass besides. Isabel was already so deeply into his and Amy's breakup that she was doing everything but taking home movies. Also, it was already past 5 o'clock. The magazine couldn't actually start to move along the postal channel between Derry and Tashmore until tomorrow morning, no matter what time it was mailed today. He would try Amy later on this evening. And if the line to the house was busy again, or if Amy was, perchance, still on the same call, he would call Isabel with the message after all. For the moment, the siren song of the couch in the living room was too strong to be denied. Mort pulled the phone jack. Whoever had tried to call him just as he was coming down the driveway would have to wait a little longer, please, and thank you, and strolled into the living room. He propped the pillows in their familiar positions, one behind his head and one behind his neck, and looked out at the lake, where the sun was setting at the end of a long and spectacular golden track. I have never felt so lonely and so utterly horrible in my whole life, he thought with some amazement. Then his lids closed slowly over his slightly bloodshot eyes, and Mort Rainey, who had yet to discover what true horror was all about, fell asleep. He dreamed he was in a classroom. It was a familiar classroom, although he couldn't have said just why. He was in the classroom with John Shooter. Shooter was holding a grocery bag in the curve of one arm. He took an orange out of the bag and bounced it reflectively up and down in his hand. He was looking in Mort's direction, but not at Mort. His gaze seemed fixed on something beyond Mort's shoulder. Mort turned and saw a cinder block wall and a blackboard and a door with a frosted glass upper panel. After a moment, he could puzzle out the backward writing on the frosted glass. Welcome to the School of Hard Knocks, it said. The writing on the blackboard was easier to read. Sewing Season, a short story by Morton Rainey, it said. Suddenly something whizzed over Mort's shoulder, just missing his head. The orange. As Mort cringed back, the orange struck the blackboard, burst open with a rotten, squashing sound, and splattered gore across what had been written there. He turned back to Shooter. Stop that! He cried in a shaky, scolding voice. Shooter dipped into his bag again. What's the matter? Shooter asked in his calm, stern voice. Don't you recognize blood oranges when you see them? What kind of writer are you? He threw another one. It splattered crimson across Mort's name and began to drip slowly down the wall. No more! Mort screamed. But Shooter dipped slowly, implacably, into the bag again. His long, calloused finger sank into the skin of the orange he brought out. Blood began to sweat its way onto the orange's skin in pinprick droplets. No more, no more, please, no more. I'll admit it. I'll admit anything, everything, if you'd just stop. Anything, if you'll just stop. If you'll... Stop. If you'll just stop. He was falling. Mort grabbed at the edge of the couch just in time to save himself a short and probably painful trip to the living room floor. He rolled toward the back of the couch and simply lay there for a moment, clutching the cushions, shivering, and trying to grasp at the ragged tails of the dream. Something about a classroom and blood oranges and the School of Hard Knocks. Even this was going, and the rest was already gone. It had been real. Whatever it was, much too real. At last he opened his eyes, but there was precious little to see. He had slept until long past sundown. He was horribly stiff, especially at the base of his neck, and he suspected he had been asleep at least 4 hours, maybe five. He felt his way cautiously to the living room light switch, managed to avoid the octagonal glass-top coffee table for a change. He had an idea the coffee table was semi-sentient, and given to shifting its position slightly after dark, the better to hack away at his shins, and then went into the front hall to try Amy again. On the way, he checked his watch. It was 10:15. He had slept over 5 hours, nor was this the first time, and he wouldn't even pay for it by tossing and turning all night. Judging by past experience, he would be asleep as soon as his head hit the pillow in the bedroom. He picked up the phone, was momentarily puzzled by the dead silence in his ear, then remembered he had yanked the damn thing's fang. He pulled the wire through his fingers until he got to the jack, turned around to plug it in, and paused. From here, he could look out the small window to the left of the door. This gave him an angle of vision on the back porch, where the mysterious and unpleasant Mr. Shooter had left his manuscript under a rock yesterday. He could also see the garbage cabinet, and there was something on it. Two somethings, actually. A white something and a dark something. The dark something looked nasty. For one frightening second, Mort thought a giant spider was crouched there. He dropped the phone cord and turned on the porch light in a hurry. Then there was a space of time, he didn't know just how long and didn't care to know, when he was incapable of further movement. The white thing was a sheet of paper, a perfectly ordinary 8.5-inch by 11-inch sheet of typing paper. Although the garbage cabinet was a good 15 feet away from where Mort was standing, the few words on it were printed in large strokes, and he could read them easily. He thought Shooter must have used either a pencil with an extremely soft lead or a piece of artist charcoal. "Remember, you have 3 days," the message read. "I am not joking." The black thing was Bump. Shooter had apparently broken the cat's neck before nailing him to the roof of the garbage cabinet with a screwdriver from Mort's own tool shed.
He wasn't aware of breaking the paralysis which held him. At one moment, he was standing frozen in the hall by the telephone table, looking out at good old Bump, who seemed to have grown a screwdriver handle in the middle of his chest where there was a ruff of white fur, what Amy had liked to call Bump's bib. At the next, he was standing in the middle of the porch with the chilly night air biting through his thin shirt, trying to look 6 different ways at once. He forced himself to stop. Shooter was gone, of course. That's why he had left the note. Nor did Shooter seem like the kind of nut who would enjoy watching Mort's obvious fear and horror. He was a nut, all right, but one which had fallen from a different tree. He had simply used Bump, used him on Mort the way a farmer might use a crowbar on a stubborn rock in his North 40. There was nothing personal in it. It was just a job that had to be done. Then he thought of how Shooter's eyes had looked that afternoon and shivered violently. No, it was personal, all right. It was all kinds of personal. "He believes I did it," Mort whispered to the cold western Maine night, and the words came out in ragged chunks, bitten off by his chattering teeth. "The crazy son of a bitch really believes I did it." He approached the garbage cabinet, and his stomach rolled over like a dog doing a trick. Cold sweat broke out on his forehead, and he wasn't sure he could take care of what needed taking care of. Bump's head was cocked far to the left, giving him a grotesque, questioning look. His teeth, small, neat, and needle-sharp, were bared. There was a little blood around the blade of the screwdriver at the point where it was driven into his bib, rough, but not very much. Bump was a friendly cat. If Shooter had approached him, Bump would not have shied away. And that was what Shooter must have done, Mort thought, and wiped the sick sweat off his forehead. He had picked the cat up, snapped its neck between his fingers like a popsicle stick, and then nailed it to the slanting roof of the garbage cabinet. All while Mort Rainey slept, if not the sleep of the just, that of the unheeding. Mort crumpled up the sheet of paper, stuffed it in his back pocket, then put his hand on Bump's chest. The body, not stiff and not even entirely cold, shifted under his hand. His stomach rolled again, but he forced his other hand to close around the screwdriver's yellow plastic handle and pull it free. He tossed the screwdriver onto the porch and held poor old Bump in his right hand like a bundle of rags. Now his stomach was in free fall, simply rolling and rolling and rolling. He lifted one of the two lids on top of the garbage cabinet and secured it with the hook and eyelet that kept the heavy lid from crashing down on the arms or head of whoever was depositing trash inside. 3 cans were lined up within. Mort lifted the lid from the center one and deposited Bump's body gently inside. It lay draped over the top of an olive-green hefty bag, like a fur stole. He was suddenly furious with Shooter. If the man had appeared in the driveway at that second, Mort would have charged him without a second thought, driven him to the ground, and choked him if he could. Easy. It really is catching. Maybe it was. And maybe he didn't care. It wasn't just that Shooter had killed his only companion in this lonely October house by the lake. It was that he had done it while Mort was asleep, and in such a way that good old Bump had become an object of revulsion, something it was hard not to puke over. Most of all, it was the fact that he had been forced to put his good cat in a garbage can like a piece of worthless trash. I'll bury him tomorrow, right over in that soft patch to the left of the house, in sight of the lake. Yes. But tonight, Bump would lie in undignified state on top of a hefty bag in the garbage cabinet because some man, some crazy son of a bitch, could be out there. And the man had a grudge over a story Mort Rainey hadn't even thought of for the last 5 years or so. The man was crazy, and consequently Mort was afraid to bury Bump tonight because, note or no note, Shooter might be out there. I want to kill him. And if the crazy bastard pushes me much more, I might just try to do it. He went inside, slammed the door, and locked it. Then he walked deliberately through the house, locking all the doors and windows. When that was done, he went back to the window by the porch door and stared pensively out into the darkness. He could see the screwdriver lying on the boards and the dark round hole the blade had made when Shooter plunged it into the right-hand lid of the garbage cabinet. All at once, he remembered he had been about to try Amy again. He plugged the jack into the wall. He dialed rapidly, fingers tapping the old familiar keys which added up to home, and wondered if he would tell Amy about Bump. There was an unnaturally long pause after the preliminary clicks. He was about to hang up when there was one final click, so loud it was almost a thud, followed by a robot voice telling him that the number he had dialed was out of service. "Wonderful," he muttered. "What the hell did you do, Amy? Use it until it broke?" He pushed the disconnect button down, thinking he would have to call Isabel Fortin after all, and while he was conning his memory for her number, the telephone rang in his hand. He hadn't realized how keyed up he was until that happened. He gave a squeaky little cry and skipped backward, dropping the telephone handset on the floor and then almost tripping over the goddamn bench Amy had bought and put by the telephone table, the bench absolutely no one, including Amy herself, ever used. He pawed out with one hand, grabbed the bookcase, and kept himself from falling. Then he snatched up the phone and said, "Hello? Is that you, Shooter?" For in that moment, when it seemed that the whole world was slowly but surely turning topsy-turvy, he couldn't imagine who else it could be. "Mort?" It was Amy, and she was nearly screaming. He knew the tone very well from the last 2 years of their marriage. It was either frustration or fury, more likely the latter. "Mort, is that you? Is it you, for God's sakes? Mort, yes, it's me," he said. He suddenly felt very weary. "Where in the hell have you been? I've been trying to get you for the last 3 hours. "Asleep," he said. "You pulled the jack?" She spoke in the tired but accusatory tone of one who had been down this road before. "Well, you picked a great time to do it this time, champ."
"I tried to call around 5.
"I was at Ted's."
"Well, somebody was there," he said. "Maybe..."
"What do you mean, someone was there?" she asked. "Whiplash quick. Who was there?"
"How the hell would I know, Amy? You're the one in Derry, remember? You, Derry, me, Tashmore. All I know is that the line was busy when I tried to call you. If you were over at Ted's, then I assume Isabel..."
"I'm still at Ted's," she said. And now her voice was queerly flat. "I guess I'll be at Ted's for quite a while to come, like it or not. Someone burned our house down, Mort. Someone burned it right to the ground." And suddenly, Amy began to cry.
He had become so fixated on John Shooter that his immediate assumption, as he stood numbly in the hallway of the one remaining Rainey home with the telephone screwed against his ear, was that Shooter had burned the house down. Motive? Why, certainly, officer. He burned the house, a restored Victorian worth about $800,000, to get rid of a magazine. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, to be precise, June of 1980 issue. But could it have been Shooter? Surely not. The distance between Derry and Tashmore was over 100 miles, and Bump's body had still been warm and flexible, the blood around the screwdriver blade tacky but not yet dry. If he hurried... Ah, quit it, why don't you? Pretty soon you'll be blaming Shooter for your divorce and thinking you've been sleeping 16 hours out of every 24 because Shooter has been putting phenobarb in your food. And after that, you can start writing letters to the paper saying that America's cocaine kingpin is a gentleman from Crow's Ass, Mississippi, named John Shooter, that he killed Jimmy Hoffa and also happened to be the famous second gun who fired at Kennedy from the grassy knoll in November of 1963. The man's crazy, okay.
Do you really think he drove 100 miles north and massacred your goddamn house in order to kill a magazine? Especially when there must be copies of that magazine still in existence all across America? Get serious! But still, if he hurried... No. It was ridiculous. But Mort suddenly realized he wouldn't be able to show the man his goddamn proof, would he? Not unless... The study was at the back of the house. They had converted what had once been the loft of the carriage barn. Amy, he said. It's so horrible, she wept. I was at Ted's, and Isabel called. She said there were at least 15 fire trucks there, hoses spraying, crowds, rubberneckers, gawkers. You know how I hate it when people come and gawk at the house, even when it's not burning down. He had to bite down hard on the insides of his cheeks to stifle a wild bray of laughter. To laugh now would be the worst thing, the cruelest thing he could possibly do, because he did know. His success at his chosen trade after the years of struggle had been a great and fulfilling thing for him. He sometimes felt like a man who had won his way through a perilous jungle, where most other adventurers perish, and has gained a fabulous prize by so doing. Amy had been glad for him, at least initially, but for her there had been a bitter downside, the loss of her identity, not only as a private person, but as a separate person. Yes, he said as gently as he could, still biting at his cheeks to protect against the laughter which threatened. If he laughed, it would be at her unfortunate choice of phrasing, but she wouldn't see it that way. So often during their years together, she had misinterpreted his laughter. Yes, I know, hon. Tell me what happened. Somebody burned down our house, Amy cried terribly. That's what happened. Is it a total loss? Yes, that's what the fire chief said. He could hear her gulping, trying to get herself under control, and then her tears stormed out again. It burned flat. Even my study? That's where it started, she sniffled. At least that's what the fire chief said they thought. And it fits with what Patty saw. Patty Champion? The Champions owned the house next to the Rainies on the right. The two lots were separated by a belt of yew trees that had slowly run wild over the years. Yes, just a second more. He heard a mighty honk as she blew her nose, and when she came back on the line, she seemed more composed. Patty was walking her dog, she told the fireman. This was a little while after it got dark. She walked past our house and saw a car parked under the portico. Then she heard a crash from inside and saw fire in your big study window. Did she see what kind of car it was? Mort asked. He felt sick in the pit of his stomach. As the news sank in, the John Shooter business began to dwindle in size and importance. It wasn't just the goddamn June 1980 issue of EQMM. It was almost all his manuscripts, both those which had been published and those which were incomplete. It was most of his first editions, his foreign editions, his contributors' copies. Ah, but that was only the start. They had lost their books, as many as 4,000 volumes. All of Amy's clothes would have burned if the damage was as bad as she said it was. And the antique furniture she had collected, sometimes with his help, but mostly on her own, would all be cinders and clinkers now. Her jewelry and their personal papers, insurance policies, and so on, would probably be okay. The safe hidden at the back of the upstairs closet was supposed to be fireproof. But the Turkish rugs would be ash, the 1,000 or so videotapes melted lumps of plastic, the audio-visual equipment, his clothes, their photographs, thousands of them. Good Christ. And the first thing he'd thought of was that goddamn magazine. No, Amy was saying, answering the question he had almost forgotten asking in his realization of how enormous the personal loss must be. She couldn't tell what kind of car it was. She said she thought somebody must have used a Molotov cocktail or something like that, because of the way the fire came up in the window right after the sound of breaking glass. She said she started up the driveway and then the kitchen door opened and a man ran out. Bruno started to bark at him, but Patty got scared and pulled him back, although she said he just about ripped the leash out of her hand. Then the man got into the car and started it up. He turned on the headlights, and Patty said they almost blinded her. She threw her arm up to shield her eyes, and the car just roared out from under the portico. That's what she said. And she squeezed back against our front fence and pulled Bruno as hard as she could, or the man would have hit him. Then he turned out of the driveway and drove down the street fast. And she never saw what kind of car it was. No. First it was dark, and then when the fire started to shine through your study window, the headlights dazzled her. She ran back to the house and called the fire department. Isabel said they came fast, but you know how old our house is. Was, and how fast dry wood burns, especially if you use gasoline. Yes, he knew. Old, dry, full of wood, the house had been an arsonist wet dream. But who? If not Shooter, who?
This terrible news, coming on top of the day's events like a hideous dessert at the end of a loathsome meal, had almost completely paralyzed his ability to think. He said it was probably gasoline, the fire chief, I mean. He was there first, but then the police came and they kept asking questions, Mort. Mostly about you, about any enemies you might have made. Enemies? And I said I didn't think you had any enemies. I tried to answer all his questions.
I'm sure you did the best job you could, he said gently. She went on as if she hadn't heard him, speaking in breathless ellipses, like a telegraph operator relating dire news aloud just as it spills off the wire.
I didn't even know how to tell them we were divorced. And of course they didn't know. It was Ted who had to tell them finally. Mort, my mother's Bible. It was on the nightstand in the bedroom. There were pictures in it of my family, and it was the only thing of hers I had. Her voice dissolved into miserable sobs.
I'll be up in the morning, he said. If I leave at 7, I can be there by 9:30. Maybe by 9, now that there's no summer traffic. Where will you stay tonight? At Ted's?
Yes, she said, sniffling. I know you don't like him, Mort, but I don't know what I would have done without him tonight. How I could have handled it, you know, all their questions.
Then I'm glad you had him, he said firmly. He found the calmness, the civilization, in his voice really astounding. Take care of yourself. Have you got your pills? She'd had a tranquilizer prescription for the last 6 years of their marriage, but only took them when she had to fly, or, he remembered, when he had some public function to fulfill, one which required the presence of the designated spouse.
They were in the medicine cabinet, she said dully. It doesn't matter, I'm not stressed, just heartsick.
Mort almost told her he believed they were the same thing and decided not to. I'll be there as soon as I can, he said. If you think I could do something by coming tonight.
No, she said. Where should we meet? Ted's?
Suddenly, unbidden, he saw his hand holding a chambermaid's passkey, saw it turning in the lock of a motel room door, saw the door swinging open, saw the surprised faces above the sheet, Amy's on the left, Ted Milner's on the right. His blow-dried look had been knocked all aslant in a sprawl by sleep, and to Mort he had looked a little bit like Alfalfa in the old little rascal short subjects. Seeing Ted's hair and sleep corkscrews like that had also made the man look really real to Mort for the first time. He had seen their dismay and their bare shoulders, and suddenly, almost randomly, he thought, a woman who would steal your love when your love was really all you had. No, he said, not Ted's. What about that little coffee shop on Wycham Street?
Would you prefer I came alone?
She didn't sound angry, but she sounded ready to be angry.
How well I know her, he thought. Every move, every lift and drop of her voice, every turn of phrase. And how well she must know me.
No, he said. Bring Ted. That'd be fine. Not fine, but he could live with it, he thought.
9:30 then, she said, and he could hear her standing down a little. Marchman's.
Is that the name of the place?
Yes. Marchman's Restaurant.
Okay, 9:30 or a little earlier. If I get there first, I'll chalk a mark on the door.
And if I get there first, I'll rub it out.
And she finished the old catechism, and they both laughed a little. Mort found that even the laugh hurt. They knew each other all right. Wasn't that what the years together were supposed to be for? Wasn't that why it hurt so goddamn bad when you discovered that not only could the years end, they really had? He suddenly thought of the note which had been stuck under one of the garbage cabinet's shake shingles. Remember, you have 3 days. I am not joking. He thought of saying, I've had a little trouble of my own down here, Amy. And then he knew he couldn't add that to her current load of woe. It was his trouble.
If it had happened later, at least you would have saved your stuff, she was saying. I don't like to think about all the manuscripts you must have lost, Mort. If you'd gotten the fireproof drawers 2 years ago when Herb suggested them, maybe...
I don't think it matters, Mort said. I've got the manuscript of the new novel down here. He did, too. All 14 shitty wooden pages of it. To hell with the rest.
I'll see you tomorrow, Amy. I love you.
He closed his lips over it.
They were divorced. Could he still love her? It seemed almost perverse. And even if he did he have any right to say so? I'm sorry as hell about this, he told her instead.
So am I, Mort. So very sorry.
She was starting to cry again. Now he could hear someone, a woman, probably Isabel Fortin, comforting her. Get some sleep, Amy.
You too.
He hung up. All at once, the house seemed much quieter than it had on any of the other nights he had been here alone. He could hear nothing but the night wind whispering around the eaves, and very far off a loon calling on the lake. He took the note out of his pocket, smoothed it out, and read it again. It was the sort of thing you were supposed to put aside for the police. In fact, it was the sort of thing you weren't even supposed to touch until the police had had a chance to photograph it and work their juju on it. It was, ruffle of drums and blast of trumpets, please, evidence. Well, fuck it, Mort thought, crumpling it up again. No police. Dave Newsom, the local constable, probably had trouble remembering what he'd eaten for breakfast by the time lunch rolled around. And he couldn't see taking the matter to either the county sheriff or the state police. After all, it wasn't as though an attempt had been made on his life. His cat had been killed. But a cat wasn't a person. And in the wake of Amy's devastating news, John Shooter simply didn't seem as important anymore. He was one of the crazy folks. He had a bee in his bonnet, and he might be dangerous. But Mort felt more and more inclined to try and handle the business himself, even if Shooter was dangerous, especially if he was dangerous. The house in Derry took precedence over John Shooter and John Shooter's crazy ideas. It even took precedence over who had done the deed, Shooter or some other fruitcake with a grudge, a mental problem, or both. The house. And, he supposed, Amy. She was clearly in bad shape. And it couldn't hurt either of them for him to offer her what comfort he could. Maybe she would even... But he closed his mind to any speculation about what Amy might even do. He saw nothing but pain down that road. Better to believe that road was closed for good. He went into the bedroom, undressed, and lay down with his hands behind his head. The loon called again, desperate and distant. It occurred to him again that Shooter could be out there, creeping around, his face a pale circle beneath his odd black hat. Shooter was nuts, and although he had used his hands and a screwdriver on Bump, that did not preclude the possibility that he still might have a gun. But Mort didn't think Shooter was out there, armed or not. Calls, he thought. I'll have to make at least two on my way up to Derry, one to Greg Carstairs and one to Herb Creekmore. Too early to make them from here if I leave at 7, but I could use one of the payphones at the Augusta toll booth. He turned over on his side, thinking it would be a long time before he fell asleep tonight after all. And then sleep rolled over him in a smooth, dark wave. And if anyone came to peer in on him as he slept, he did not know it.